Once again, I have Jeff Lawton on the phone with me, and I think we kind of got Jeff pulled in because we wanted to do a promotion this week, and Jeff said okay, and so we're promoting, which I believe is Jeff, your best video, the Food Forests video, and we're doing this out at Permies this week, and of course a lot of people are going to listen to this like after the promotion, but I think most people listen to it before the promotion. Welcome, Jeff Lawton.
Thank you very much.
So basically this week you'll be answering people's questions like in the forums, and so they can come up with the wackiest, the most bizarre, most unusual questions and bombard you with them, and you'll be able to set the world right on every topic permaculture.
Yeah, I mean, I hope they've got some well-thought-out questions, because we'll try and give them some well-thought-out answers.
And you're going to be the keynote speaker in Northern California about mid-October. It looks like it's going to be October, I think I saw October 12th and 14th in San Ramon, Northern California Permaculture Convergence. Do you know what you're going to present on?
I think I'm presenting on how to set up permaculture institutes and demonstration sites and education centres, how to extend permaculture out as far as we can, as fast as we can. So, great. Always love to be in that area of the world. There's so much activity in that area. And the only place that I know that has Herb Robert as the main weed, which is just a wonderful thing.
Now, for this trip, are you going to just fly in, be the keynote guy, and then fly out again? Is that how your life works?
It has done a lot, unfortunately. But now I'm actually teaching for 5 days afterwards, a workshop on applying permaculture patterns, water harvesting and food forests and that sort of thing. And that'll go for 5 days, and then I fly out. And I go to Jordan. I teach a course in Jordan in the Dead Sea Valley, a PDC, a Permaculture Design Steward course. And then we have the first 5 week, I think it is, internship, drylands internship there in Jordan, and it will be September. So good time of year to be there, and lots of things going on, planning up at that time. And we're building all kinds of things on the project there, putting in aquaculture, wicking beds, new solar system, community garden, all sorts of stuff. And then I fly to Marrakesh in Morocco, where we have a brand new permaculture research institute set up. I'm teaching a course, PDC, in Morocco. I might then hopefully get a little bit of surf, because it's a good time of year to surf in Morocco there in December, and then I'll be home for the winter surf season, hopefully.
I never thought that. When I think of Morocco, I don't think of like surfing. Okay. So
West Coast, South Coast in Morocco in winter is very good. Excellent. And yeah, I'm a surfer and a fisherman when I get time, it's pretty good over here too, in Australia, of course.
Right. The only thing I remember is from Australia about surfing and about being in the water is that apparently there's like some pretty pretty horrible critters that can be in the water. Jellyfish are apparently an issue.
Yeah, we've got all kinds of nasties over here. It gets you ready for action, be it surviving this place.
It toughens you up a little bit.
Yeah.
All right. So recently you and I were talking about detractors, and we were talking about how some of the people that we know of that are leaders, that are people that have really accomplished a lot of really wonderful things, just seem to be riddled to the gills with detractors. And we also talked a little bit about how some of the people that are the leaders in the permaculture world, some of them are more charming than others. And in fact, charming is something that can sometimes be hard to find. Diplomacy can be hard to find. I kind of advocate that it's not that the people that are currently a bit tougher that they were not born that way, that at one point in time they were very sweet and gentle people. But I believe, it's my theory, my philosophy, that a parade of 20,000 skeptics kind of made them the way that they are. For the first 5,000 or so, they were still sweet and kind and generous people, and then around 10,000 they kind of started to become a little grumpy, and somewhere around 20,000 then it's kind of like they became who they are today. And I thought you had some amazing insight into this for both of these aspects, both the fact that there are detractors, evidence that good people do have detractors, as well as how the personalities are formed.
Yeah. I think it's a certain amount of human nature. It's well known if you become a master of a subject, you've spent at least 10,000 hours passionately engaging in that subject. That's 40 hours a week for 5 years, and no matter what you do. If you put that much time in, you're mastering. It's like you become a master chef. You know, you don't need a recipe book anymore. You can sort of go on a blink decision. You use a lot of intuition, and things seem really obvious to you. And often it's hard to reflect back on what it was like to master the subject. And difficult questions come to you over time, and you get to spend a lot of time thinking about mainframe elements, which can seem the simple elements to the newly initiated, but the masters of a subject think more about the mainframe than they do about the details. The devil's in the details, and you don't need to get distracted by the details so much, because they almost become the elements that have intuitive responses to your inquiry when you've mastered it. So it can get sort of frustrating, and you have to really realize that you've got to work on yourself to help other people who are reasonably new into a subject when you've mastered it. And it's easy to get a bit spiky. You're like a pioneer plant. You keep coming up in damaged ground. And you have, human beings have the ability to change and make judgment calls on how they should be and how they should maybe change. I like to think of the students I've produced becoming the new canopy and going above me. And I'm trying to get out of being a spiky weed. I have that intention to become a sophisticated understory in the shade of the canopy that I've helped create. And those are the new generations coming through. They're really much more like peacemakers and team players than the original spiky weeds. And I think of permaculture, that is, and all systems. It's kind of observational reflection here that I'm talking about. You have to realize that the more popular you get, as people like what you do, almost as many people hate what you do, and maybe are jealous of what your success and that's recorded in history. And even prophets like Jesus Christ were crucified, and yet and obviously loved by the masses. And so it's something to sort of expect. But I think maybe we should look at evolving past that, and the vast majority of people should realize what is actually happening and change with intention to be a little bit more tolerant of each other. And when the larger percentage of us realize that when you're working for the greater good to achieve something so meaningful, we have to be extremely tolerant. And once the larger percentage of us do that, that tipping point might be the evolution of human thinking into a perpetually designed abundance of the future. And that may be that stage. That maybe we may pass here through a threshold of adolescence to truly civilized adulthood as a species, and as a species that is obviously so important to everything that exists on the planet.
So when you say all of this stuff about maturity and reaching adulthood and being less spiky, then I don't know whether I just have these obnoxious humor needs or what, but I kind of keep thinking like But I'm having fun being an adolescent, and I like things spiky. It meets my humor needs, and things like that. I should probably go, yes, what you're saying is I agree, and we'll all try to be smoother and nicer and things like that. Maybe I will always be spiky, and I just won't be part of the canopy. I'll have to move outside of the canopy and go be spiky somewhere else.
It doesn't stop you having fun. I think being a little bit more refined, and it's very fulfilling to sort of help and mentor people as you become more of an elder in a movement. It's lovely to see the young people grow beyond and expect them and ask them to grow beyond your achievements and knowledge. Give it away. Give away your knowledge with ask and expect your students to go past you and be better than you. I'd like all my students to be better designers, consultants and teachers than I am. And it's wonderful. I could just come home and garden then. So I think Graham Bell, I'd like to quote Graham Bell here, who's the wonderful Scottish permaculturist who wrote the book The Permaculture Way. And Graham said, if you're not having fun, you've got the design wrong. We need to bear that in mind.
I like that. Yeah. So as opposed to being in something where it's kind of like a lot of work, it does seem like you if you create a good permaculture system. I mean, the thing I keep saying is that when you create the permaculture system right, well, when I create a good permaculture system, I can be even lazier. And so I kind of wonder if when you're lazy, is that more fun? That sounds like more fun.
Well, I think you just love to be inside the systems you've created. You feel a lot of contentment. To quote Yakuba Sawadogo, the man who stopped the desert, there's a video of him on our website now. Wonderful man who stopped the desert in West Africa there by installing forests and using permaculture principles. He's probably never heard of the word permaculture until recently. In his video, he talks about the most enjoyable place for him to be is inside the forest that he's grown. And you hear people say things like that about the forest in Oroville and all the other classic places that we've reforested the earth and influenced it towards productivity. Nothing stops us having fun. I think that's essential, and I think that's why it's so important to have a permaculture party at the end of a PDC where people get out and perform in front of each other and feel safe doing it, and really entertain each other. It's self-sufficient fun, and there's nothing more entertaining and it's very wealthy. It's rich to see other people perform in front of you, even with their serious or painful or silly or humorous ways. We're very tolerant of each other when we've engaged in a joint mission. So we've decided to go into service and help the world with our system, and we can entertain each other incredibly well, sort of self-sufficient fun in such a wonderful way.
So now I've had a lot of people ask me about the PDC, the talent night for on the last day of the PDC, and that they believe that there should not be one. And my response has always been that because it doesn't really add to the knowledge, that it doesn't really, you know, they've got their reasons. They've got their very logical, formal reasons. And you know, frankly, their reasons are all correct. It's true. Their reasons are all correct. At the same time, the thing I always say is, you know what? This is a permaculture design course. And there was this guy, Mollison. He made up the word, and he laid out what a PDC looks like and stuff like that. So, and he said, when you're at the end of the course, this is what you do. This is what you do on the last day. And so, therefore, if you want to call yourself, you know, you want to say that you've completed a PDC, if you want to say that, this is part of it. This is part of what you do. If you don't want to do that, don't start the PDC. I think that it is a piece. And granted, it's goofy, and it ends up being fun, even if you're sure it won't.
every time. people have said that some of the best parties they've ever seen. And I've had many people that don't want to perform, and I said, okay, it's all right. I can help you with it. I've seen so many interesting acts and party games. I can help you every time perform. It's easy. But I say absolutely, this is an essential part of the PDC. We have to learn to be able to entertain each other, have self-sufficient fun, have that connection to humanity. It's so important. And I've seen the most incredible performances. Incredible. And what I test you with this, I test anybody with this. Put young children, 5 years old and younger, in that room and watch their faces. Watch a two-year-old watch adults do that, and they are in a state of wonder as they watch all those events. For them, it is the most incredible thing. Now, I think, you know, we have to realize that we're missing something here if we don't help each other in that way. And for a teacher, there are two things that give you an indication you've done a good job. One is watching your students present their design exercise, which is kind of terrifying as a teacher. There are some, and you have to point out, I never criticize, I never give feedback. I let people, it's hard enough to get up there and present, but I only point out type one errors, because you have to point them out if they're something that obviously won't work. And you, very, very diplomatically.
You are kinder than I. I always criticize, and it's never diplomatic.
No. I'm very gentle with people on that, and because I really appreciate the courage it takes to get up and present in front of your peers. It's a information anchoring experience, anchored by the emotions. But then the other thing is, if there's a good party, it's also a sign of appreciation that you have listened to what your teacher said about the party. And as a teacher, you work very hard on that last night. I'm working until the party finishes. I'm often the master of ceremonies, the person who keeps the party buzzing. I'm the one who encourages people to act. On that last party night, I'm working right to the last minute. It might not look like it, but I am. I'm keeping it rolling. And something else, there's always an act that stops the room. There's an act that someone does that links to a tradition or a ceremony or a cultural song or poem or something that stops the room so you could cut the air with a knife. I wait for that moment, and I'm the one who's looking around thinking, yes, we've got it. We've got that moment that everybody goes, oh my goodness. And it's a freeze frame moment. I've seen it in all cultures. Wonderful, wonderful stuff. Shouldn't leave it out. No, you're missing something if you do.
Well, and the thing I've seen at some PDCs is that there are some people. I mean, first of all, if you don't feel comfortable with a talent, you can just stand up and tell a joke. I mean, that qualifies. That gets it done. But what I've seen is some people who really do have no talent whatsoever. And I saw at this last one I was at, it was really an amazing thing. A guy basically read a song, and then there was another guy that simply played, that had talent, that played a guitar to go with it. And it was a funny little, it was a funny thing, something that he saw on a television show. He found the script and he basically read this thing, and it was actually so good that I've actually gone and looked it up on the internet several times to enjoy it again. But it's amazing. You can come up with stuff. You collaborate with others is a great way to go, and then they'll hopefully carry you, and they'll probably have so much fun doing it that no one will notice that you really can't do what you're about to do.
I've seen people who play so bad that you know, but everybody moves in a caring sort of way towards them, and they sympathize with their lack of ability, and it's also lovely and caring that event. But I've also had people perform incredible quality. I've had opera and wonderful, harmonica, professional musicians come out of nowhere, and we've had compost wrestling in New York State, and that's actually on YouTube. And I've even had anarchists get up and sit in a chair in front of everybody and say, I'm going to do an act called Civil Disobedience. And I just they sit there and do nothing for 2 minutes and then walk off. That's fine, you know, fine.
I want to say that's not fine, and that doesn't count. Get up there and do something else. So, you are a far kinder man than I am, Jeff. But I do think, you know, this kind of comes back to another little aspect. This is something I want to ask you, as long as we're kind of on the topic, and that is that when I took my PDC, it was like January of 2005, and so I'm a student, and I'd read all of the books, and I'd been practicing something permaculture-esque for many years, and so really what I wanted is, I loved the word so much, I wanted to use the word in what I was doing. And so it's like, okay, in order to do it appropriately, to respect the others in the permaculture community, the thing that you do is you take a PDC. And it was one of the most amazing experiences that I've ever had. And there have been many times that I've longed to go back in time and re-experience those 2 weeks. But all I really wanted was to be able to be allowed to use the word. And when I arrived, I didn't know that there was the talent night requirement. And I was, you know, kind of feeling a little grumpy and cranky about, I shouldn't have to do this. This is stupid, kind of a thing. And then, of course, I did end up having a great time and lots of fun, even though I'm not really a party person. So I guess it comes back to, like, what is the current position of PRI. I mean, you are the director of PRI, and on top of that, I think that when it comes right now, I've referred to you before as the crown prince of permaculture. So I think Bill has made it clear that you are inheriting all that is permaculture. And so what is, when people use the word permaculture, what's okay, what's not okay? I'm just checking in to see what the official word of the moment is.
Well, you have to be operating within the ethics of permaculture.
And let me ask you this, just to be clear, am I, Paul Wheaton, currently acting, to the best of your knowledge, within the ethics of permaculture?
As far as I know, yeah, you are.
Okay. Because there's a lot of people that are sure that I'm not. So, but anyway, I would have to say, so then in order to use the word permaculture site, somebody's going to go out and they're going to say, this is Bob's permaculture farm. Then I was under the impression that it would be inappropriate to have, to call your farm that unless you've completed a PDC.
It's probably more polite, let's say, but if they're operating within the ethics of permaculture, in other words, you can't call something a permaculture because it's not a anything. It's a system of design. So you can say, this is a farm that uses permaculture design, or this is a permaculture farm by design. You know, it's using a design system. If it's inside the ethics of permaculture, it really can't easily be challenged. Right. So that may be someone who's employed a permaculture consultant to design the farm, and they themselves haven't necessarily taken a PDC. But you can't teach permaculture without having taken a PDC. That we can challenge. Right. But outside of that, if people are using the ethics, why would we challenge them? Why would it be a challenge?
Okay. I mean, would you say that
eventually that, you know, people will be using the word permaculture ethically and they won't have taken a PDC? That doesn't matter, I think.
I want to get some clarity here. Now, would you say that they can't teach a PDC without having taken a PDC?
Correct.
Or that they can't teach any permaculture at all unless they've taken a PDC?
No, they could teach principles. I can't see any reason why that wouldn't be considered within the ethics. But if you need to have taken a PDC to teach a PDC, because anybody who's listening would obviously, I think, agree with me that a PDC is a transformative event. When all of a sudden the literature and even the big black book, as you call it, the designer's manual, it all of a sudden becomes readable. It's not so much of a mystery. I mean, it's no less dense. It's just as dense in information and concise in the way it describes permaculture design, but it is much more readable. All sorts of things happen after you've done a PDC, and that's rather unique, but it's not a large amount of time to take a PDC, but it's just that 72 hours or a little bit more,
right?
So that's the we don't want to dilute the effect of the PDC because it's had such an incredible effect worldwide and continues to.
Right. So now this seems to me to be a change. So I'm gonna just to be sure, I'm gonna ask it sort of kind of one more time. So what I believe the change is that before now, saying if somebody were to have Bob's Permaculture Farm and they've never taken a PDC, then other people might point at Bob and say, that's disrespecting the permaculture community, and so we're going to kind of give you the stink eye. But now, the thing is that what you're saying is that no, that's okay. Bob can have Bob's Permaculture Farm, and giving him the stink eye is not okay. Bob can't teach a PDC because he hasn't taken a PDC, but he can call his farm the Bob's Permaculture Farm. That's fine. That's okay. Everybody be nice to Bob.
Yeah, if Bob phoned me up or emailed me and said, look, everyone's giving me the stink eye just because I'm using permaculture and I haven't taken a PDC, can you help me, Jeff? I would say, Bob, look, why don't you just put up Bob's Permaculture Farm operating within the ethics of permaculture, right? Earth care, people care, and return of surplus. And then you can ask them, why don't you want me to operate within your ethics and help you with the demonstration that permaculture is a viable system that's going to save the world and create a more abundant future for all the future generations? What the hell's up with you people?
So, I'd have to say that within the three ethics, I mean, granted, in the designer's manual, the big black book, there's a lot of description of what exactly we're talking about, the three ethics. However, it seems like what we have encountered, and the problem that I have with the three ethics, and so this is where a lot of people just say that I can't call myself, or I can't call what I do permaculture, I can't refer to permaculture because I'm not functioning within the three ethics. And the thing that I've expressed is that what I see the ethics being used for is to hurt people that are attempting to do permaculture. And because of that, I'm being very frustrated with the ethics. And so it's kind of like somebody encounters a problem and it's like, how do we fix this? I have not seen a good concrete example of somebody saying, let's bring in the ethics and the ethics will fix this problem. But what I have seen over and over and over again is somebody's out there attempting to do permaculture and then somebody comes over and says, that's not permaculture because you're not using the ethics, because you didn't sing the ethics song, you didn't say it's because of the ethics, you didn't. So I'm hereby saying that's not permaculture, so you need to stop calling it permaculture. So I've seen the ethics used as a club against people who are trying to learn permaculture. But I've not seen the ethics used as a tool to help somebody do better at permaculture from a practical perspective. I've seen the ethics used for like philosophical discussions about the ethics themselves, but not like, oh, look, we're having trouble with this polyculture, this hugel culture bed, or this swale, and so let's bring in the ethics and now we understand what we're going to do and we move forward. I do see people who go out, and if they don't agree with somebody, and there's an argument, then I've seen people say, I win the argument because I hereby invoke this ethic. And my interpretation of this ethic says I'm right and you're wrong. So now you must do what I say. And so I've seen a lot of that. So I'm finding, does this make sense? Am I just babbling? I'm concerned.
Well, permaculture begins with an ethic, as you know, Bill states. And you can ask, now, what is permaculture about? And permaculture is about science and ethics. That's what we're about. And it's mostly the proven sciences and a large part the life sciences. It's an ethical design science. That's what it is. So, you know, the ethics are at the core of the system. And if you're challenged by professionals within a professional discipline that we use in permaculture, you might have to back up a bit because you're getting attacked by a professional or challenged. But you can't back up past the ethics. And from the ethics, you know, your back is against the wall, but your ethics are there. And at the ethics, you stand and you move forward from there. And I don't think anybody can challenge the ethics. Nobody. They are a synthesis of about 18 different ethics that Bill analyzed of traditional people worldwide. And when he brought them down into the most concise form, they more or less came out as those three ethics. And I think that's been a wonderful strategy, and it works fine. And there's no need to nitpick around the rest of it. Like I say before, the devil's in all those little details. You need to profoundly think about the three ethics and build your philosophy from there.
Right. I think another thing is that. It is my philosophy, and I could be wrong, that under the permaculture umbrella, there are many schools of thought. And so some people have a far more spiritual approach to permaculture, and some people have a more hands-in-the-dirt approach to permaculture. And I sometimes see people that say, you have to do permaculture the way I do permaculture, because the way I do permaculture is the way of doing permaculture. And it's kind of like I try to discourage that as much as I can, and to say, some people do it this way and some people do it this other way. But from having talked to you many times in the past, I think you're in that same boat, that you believe there's many schools of thought under the permaculture umbrella.
Unnecessarily, yeah, there are, and it's probably people who are desiring extra attention that want to define it exactly in their way. It's kind of interesting that many, many things fit into the permaculture wardrobe and hang up all different types of coats. But the coats and the coat hangers are not anything but just components of permaculture, and we, the designers, design the wardrobe that hang them in a very orderly way. People often get me to do consultancies on quite large projects here and around the world, and I find out they've had all kinds of other consultants, biodynamic consultants, soil food web consultants, Yeomans consultants, Key Lime Farm, that sort of thing, Albrook Minerals, you know, all kinds of other systems, natural farming techniques,
you know, holistic management.
Holistic management, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And they call me in as well. And these are people who can afford all these natural farming, regenerative farming, all of that. And eventually I think, oh, well, you know, I'm just another consultant they've called, and then they call me back and give me the job, and I'm kind of shocked, and I think, well, maybe I'm too cheap or something. I thought that was some kind of alternative afterthought they were adding on the end, and then I get to know the client, and eventually I'll often ask, well, how come you got me to do the main design? You know, you had all these other experts, people I've heard all over the world, and I say, how come you got me to do it? And they said, oh, you're the only one who said it all works. you're the only one that said, oh yeah, Biodynamics, that's great, that works, and you know, Albrook Minerals, that works, you know, and Yeomans, that works, and you know, like Soil Food Work, that works, and Rangeland Management, that works, and Regenerative Farming, Joel Salen stuff, that all works, that's great, it all fits in. What we need is mainframe holistic design that covers your sewage system, your house, your waste systems, the garden, the grazing, the forestry. We're going to fit it all together, and it's to fit together that works. You're the only one that said that. Everybody else said, all you need is my system. All you need is my system. Bullshit. You need everybody. You need everybody's system. You can't be exclusive in any of this, you know, and that's why you isolate yourself. Isolation doesn't work in interactive, you know, diversity. Interactive diversity is positively interactive. All right, let's get back to the system here.
I think a lot of what I've been trying to suggest is that, like, all those different people that you talked about, so, like, there's somebody who brought in a dozen different experts from a dozen different fields and then picked one. And the way I've been kind of talking about it more recently is the idea of that they brought in 12 different artists, and they've seen, like, portfolios from each artist. And at the same time, they brought the artist in to look at their canvas, which is effectively, you know, land, and to describe what kind of art they might try to do on this particular piece of canvas. And so then basically I kind of like this way of thinking a bit, like each of these artists would paint a different picture. You know, some of them might do the night sky, and some of them might do a nude, and some of them might do something pastoral. So I think there's a lot of different schools of thought in this. But yes, I also agree that I think permaculture is far more inclusive, whereas a lot of these others are either limited or even exclusive. Like they say, oh yeah, you got to do it this way, and that other way is stupid. Don't do that. Whereas permaculture is kind of like, oh no, yeah, we can do it. We can do it with this way or that way. That's fine. Both of those will work. You know, they are mutually exclusive. You got to kind of pick one or the other, or you can say we'll do one on this side of the land and the other one on the other side. But I that's one of the things I really love about permaculture is it's so inclusive.
Yeah. Yeah, and with its diversity, you could cherry pick the bad parts of permaculture and emphasize those and miss the point, unfortunately. But, you know, we are so diverse, intentionally diverse, and our system complicates itself naturally. So an indicator of a good system is that when you put it in, it doesn't simplify itself. It becomes a little bit more complex all the time, and you sit back and watch the system demonstrate its evolutions, and then you dynamically adjust. And I think we have to do that with each other as well.
I want to get onto the thing, because you've done an interesting, fascinating, awesome thing. I'm really excited to hear your feedback, and that is that. So because today we want to talk about your Food Forest DVD. And so you listened to the podcast where Helen Attow and I reviewed your DVD, and now you're going to review our review. And I'm just aching to know what you had to say. But I got one more note on my list of notes here to talk about, and that is that you've got a top secret thing coming up. But you've set something up out at permaculture.org.au just for permies, just for the people listening to this podcast, so that they can be alerted when this top secret thing is ready. And so I've got it written down here, permaculture.org.au/permies. And if people go to that, they can be notified when the top secret thing is ready. Have I given anything away I'm not supposed to give away?
It sounds very interesting. Thank you.
So is there anything you want to add to that, or is it all top secret?
That'll do for now. I just say it's a work that's passionately in progress.
Okay. All right. So permaculture.org.au/permies. Okay. So now we move on to the review of the review. And I you told me earlier that you got a page and a half of notes. And please, sir, what is your first note?
Well, my first note is an appreciation to Helen Attar, who I've only heard in your reviews together with my DVD, The Food Forest. And I must say, I really liked her interactions there. It's really nice. Well done, Helen. Great stuff. Maybe we meet one day and discuss a lot of ideas. And the first thing I put down was no magic. I completely agree with that statement. You don't need magic in a world that's so wonderful. There's plenty of science through observing nature that still appear to be magic and need extra observation. It's just good observation that leads to good science. So that to me was that anchored everything that you were talking about there. Easy in the tropics. I have to disagree. I think it's easy in the temperate. You have in the temperate, you have lovely light. You have low, long, gentle summer days, and you have a wonderful ground cover in the winter called snow, which can be put to great use. Apart from anything else, it's extremely predictable in its effect, where the unpredictability of the subtropics, which is an edge between the Mediterranean, the dry, arid, and the tropics, is horribly unpredictable, especially with climate change effects, which give us the unpredictability. So, you know, you have this, I think it's just gorgeous. The sort of nicest place, safest place, the easiest place to work is actually the temperate. And you look at history and where, you know, a lot of humanity develops, it is basically out of the temperate zones for good reason. You don't really have any less light. You just have it more at one end of the year than the other. You get a fresh start every year. You get a sterility start. It's sterile over the winter. Your decomposition happens more in the dormant time of year when you get the wet rots. You still get an evaporation over rainfall, but for a very short amount of time, usually at the end, mid to end of summer. Fine. Not quite so many layers, but real good reason, because you don't have such a high and close to vertical or vertical sun at times. You know, I wouldn't beat yourself up about being in temperate. That's actually it's quite a good deal. And your working temperatures are pretty good. You can always dress up. Here at times when the humidity is at 90% and the temperatures are over, you know, 30 plus centigrade, you can't undress anymore. You need a dam to jump in. It's probably why we've got so many. and temperate trees, I mean, yeah, look, you don't have so many large legumes, actually. You have some pretty interesting ones. There's Albizia julibriescens is an interesting one that gets quite cold, looks quite tropical. They hate it in Louisiana. Wow, phone ringing. Someone up. Oh. Wrong phone. Hold on.
All right.
They call it mimosa in Louisiana, but that's a warm climate. And it will go to quite cold temperatures, minus 10 or minus 20 on the Celsius scale. So that's interesting. Helen spoke about alder being a bit too rampant, possibly, and yet a native. It is not a legume, but a nitrogen fixer. I wouldn't worry about that. I mean, it doesn't move as fast as a a billhook or a machete, you can you can put it into action. And then you've got the non-native Eleagnus, which is also nitrogen fixing. And I know it's a weed. I know people worry about it, but I like things people worry about. They need to worry about things and see how the problem can be the solution. Classic permaculture saying. And then Paul, you were talking about the effect of black locust not rotting down when it's cut green. I think if you cut at the end of summer when the autumn rains start and you lie it down so it's like got fun, it's got a large contact with the ground, lie it on contour if possible, shorten up the log size, don't have to shred it, but shorten up the log size a bit, what you've got is a longer fungal interaction. And we find that anything that's an antifungal element, when it composts, when it decomposes, like say lavender, when you make a compost heap with a large amount of lavender in it, which you might gain from a lavender farm or something, as it decomposes, it needs a larger diversity of fungi because it's an antifungal element, lavender. And when you look at it through the microscope later, you'll see one of the largest diversities we've ever seen in the microorganisms in the compost, because the antifungal element needs a larger interaction of fungal diversity to break it down. So I could
smack it with a hammer.
I'm going to put these outside. 1 second, Paul.
All right. So I guess we wait. And I don't have any filler material. Oh no, I'm on my own. What do I do?
I'm back.
Oh good. Oh, save me. I was panicking.
Too many phones in the office. Yeah, so I was interested in that. Now, I love the thing about every element interaction is either positive, negative, or no effect. So there's only 9 different possible interactions between element A and element B, and that's positive, positive, no effect, positive, positive, no effect, negative, positive, positive, negative, no effect, no effect, negative, no effect, no effect, negative, and negative, negative. So there's 9 variations of the way you can put together a no effect, a positive, or a negative as you combine elements together. Now, if you haven't got a positive, a no effect's fine too. At least a deciduous tree that has no effect naturally in your temperate climate brings up elements, brings up minerals from way down and drops them at the surface, and that feeds microorganisms over, even over the winter there's interactions there. So I think that's all very designable and interesting, and actually looks very beautiful in the temperate. And as you move colder and colder towards the cold temperate and the real cold climates, you go towards the Scandinavian ang systems, which are the open systems where large animals have an interaction, and the pannage of large animals in the forests in the autumn go through and harvest the surplus fruits and nuts that are just too big, too large a yield to even harvest in and turn it to preserves and winter storage. And those large animals fatten on those forest products, the pannage systems of Northern Europe. And that's your extra feed for your animals before they go into the barns and inside for the winter when they're fed on, you know, your stored hay or silage. Then the fungal flush comes because the manure interaction, you know, so you've got a sort of more open system, and there's a lot of large animal interaction well-timed in those temperate forests that are possible. And they're all quite traditional. It's actually thought that England might have got its name from the word Ang, Angland, the Vikings interaction. So it was a land of ang systems, ang land. That's all. You'll hear David Holmgren talk about that quite a lot in some of his talks. David living in a cooler part of Australia than myself, down a bit further south in Victoria. So that's all. Lovely stuff. And of course, you're a wonderful permaculture author and teacher. Dave Jackie writes so well with his books from the northeast of North America there. So what you really have, I think, native, non-native, support species, all this sort of stuff that people want to sort of get upset about or point fingers at and like find it hard to get their head around. You know, you've really got a global food party going on in these systems. And why wouldn't you? I mean, apples come from Kazakhstan. Do you send them all home or, you know, what do you do? I mean, of course you want to eat apples. I mean, carrots come from Afghanistan. They were originally white and then they were selected to be purple. And it was some Dutch gardener that created the first orange carrot to honor the royal family of Holland because their color's orange. And all our carrots come from that guy's carrot. And stop eating these Dutch symbols of royalty. Get over it. I mean, you support, you know, have to buy into that. You know, you've got a global food party going on. You need a global support group. You could think about it like America. I mean, you know, America's got wonderful culture of native peoples, but also you've got an incredible cultural diversity of hardworking immigrants. Has that not made America richer? I mean, you know, it's a country full of hardworking immigrants. No, and it's enriched the culture of America. You wouldn't take it away, would you? I'm like, it's not. It's the same when you look at, you know, I love to use people's analogies to plant and forest systems because it sort of hits you somewhere personal. And I think we need a bit of a personal hit now and again. And so succession, there's all sorts of succession. And it's really time. Helen talked a lot about that. She brought in time, place, succession. But time is a fascinating thing, and it starts to sound a bit mysterious when you bring in time stacking and time succession. But you are playing with the time succession of a system, so you're stacking time into a system, and yeah, always playing with the edge of, you know, is it something that's permitted or is it something that's forced? And you should work towards permitted function rather than forced function. Something we've developed here in the last couple of years is a cattle laneway, a cell grazing laneway of hard electric wire, 6 meters wide, nearly 20 feet wide, going right around the farm in a complete loop with a few little dead ends here and there. But the electricity is a complete loop. Solar powered electricity in the wire travels very well with not a lot of resistance. And then we have 47 electric gates where we can cell graze with an electric tape and tread in temporary that are completely flexible. We can move our grazing pattern, so we can cell graze our cows and a few horses and dairy cows and beef cows, but they're moving in a holistic rangeland management type pattern, but throughout the polyculture of this permaculture institute, which is just a wonderful interaction that now has some sort of rational rational patterning. Areas that are not ideal in the future to be continuously grazed can be grazed twice within 30 to 50 day cycle, and then a chicken tractor system, which is 50 meters of electric net within surrounding areas of 150 square meters, which is quite an area, and it will put together quite a stable forest ecosystem. They're chicken tractoring over there for about 2 to 3 weeks. They don't completely bare the ground. They don't remove every single weed. We don't turn them into chicken compactors. There's a big difference between a compactor and a tractor used properly. I mean, you can use a tractor to be a compactor, but we don't really. We'd rather use a tractor to be a yeoman's plow key line reliever of compaction. So you've got to watch. You've got to watch your chickens and not just hammer in the ground and
It sounds like that this is different from what we saw in the video. So I think what you're saying is that your systems have evolved for chickens since the video. Is that what you're saying?
Well, as we've moved up, typically we started at the center and moved out. So our systems have got bigger. So we're moving a larger area. We proved successional moves of chicken tractors to plant permanent forests behind them. Some of those forests, some of them food forests now, are fenced around almost an acre, and they have permanent free-range chickens inside the forest that their ancestors prepared. So the same chickens didn't come back because it was a few years later before the forest was stable enough to have permanent chicken interaction. So we've used chickens to establish a forest, but now we're actually pre-preparing the ground with cell grazing events. 2 or 3 cell grazing events actually increase the carbon footprint, in the soil. They prepare the ground. Then the chicken's given an intense preparation. Then we come in and might do a little bit of tilling or pull up a few of the residual weeds, and we'll feed the chickens while they're in there with some comfrey and some other carbon elements, mulch elements from what they've already planted on the moves before. And then we'll move them on and move quickly into a food forest. So instead of, 10 square meters at a time, we're doing 150 square meters at a time. So we're chunking our way across the landscape into permanent food forestry where it's appropriate. And other areas are going into better and better grazing where the slopes and the area is appropriate. So it's an evolution. We're just, and I think everything in these systems are evolutions, and we need to keep reporting on them. Then we're on the tip of the iceberg. We're not there, nowhere near complete yet. There's many, many fractals to go yet in the success. But I'd like to say also that you can use frost as a succession. So I've seen, in Macedonia, we deep ripped on contour between our large swale system, and I saw temperatures go down to -20 centigrade and up and down around the deep minus temperatures, and thaw and frost and thaw and frost, and I saw the soil heave to the surface by the expansion of the ice. I saw what I realized I was seeing was minor glacial events within the rip lines on contour that we'd actually facilitated. All we're ever doing is facilitating a creative event in different successional cycles. So even frost, right, can be used in a positive successional event. Wind in desert and dry lands, there's a lot of airborne nutrient. When you put up the right wind breaks, you're harvesting airborne nutrient and you're dropping it out on the leeward side of wind breaks. So you're creating the potential of an enriched creative event of life systems. You're extending the depth of the windbreak. You can start with a windbreak, you can end up with a leeward food forest, and it can increase in diversity and productivity, and you start off with windbreak. I mean, it's because there's airborne nutrient in the wind, and you've designed in relation to that. So your design pattern, it doesn't always line up with contour, but you can complement the two together. And the same with flood succession. There's flood regimes of particular time cycles. You can put up flood barriers that are tree belts that slow the floodwaters across the floodplain and drop mulch on the upside and silt on the downside of the pattern tree line. So it's a harmonic pattern off the floodplain, and you'll actually build the potential for a very abundant life-rich facilitation of an event. I mean, this is something that, you know, you then move on from there to, you know, the fungal events within the time and the space of that happening. So, we need to keep our creative minds open on what we can do, as long as we're sort of harmonizing with the time, events, and the continuum of form in the landscape. And things reveal themselves to you. You suddenly see something that's been in front of you for a while, and you realize, wow, I could really enhance that, and I could increase this effect. And that always leads to facilitating more of a creative event. And on we go, discovering new things all the time. It is reasonably infinite, and that's what happens to you. You become comfortable with infinity. And you realize you're never going to get to the end of it, and it's a damn good thing you don't. You're always going to have new things to discover. And that keeps you very vital and excited and moving forward and engaged in every moment of the day, which is your personal time event. So we then went on, and you and Helen had a big discussion about nitrogen. And whether plants fix nitrogen while they're growing, or do they have to be stressed, or do they have to be chopped, or do they have to die? Obviously, there is a major event when they do eventually pass out of the system, or when they're chopped or stressed, and their roots release nitrogen. And in the final event of their death, you have this wonderful dendritic pattern running down in reverse into the soil, which is the ultimate soakage pattern that becomes compost corridors in the soil. But I'd like to point out that the microorganisms in the soil have a continuous interaction with the root zones of plants, and particularly the bacteria, the very small organisms, they have to put out a gel to stick themselves to the plants, otherwise they get washed through the soil, and that becomes like a rhizomophere around the root zone. And that gel is created from starch. And they don't create the starch. They get the starch as a currency exchange from the plant. And the plant gets the starch from photosynthesis. Now, for that exchange, they give the plant nitrogen. But they themselves are extremely high in nitrogen. The bacteria are up to 90% nitrogen in their bodies. So it's in suspension in the soil. Now, they're fed from the carbon and starch, the sugars and starches and the carbons created from photosynthesis. Now, nitrogen fixing plants are very good at this because they're fed by the bacteria. So you get more bacteria interaction with the plants that function the fastest, which create more bacteria. It's a to and fro thing. So if you want to look at it that way, there's more nitrogen there. But also, the bodies of the plants. If you look at the hierarchy of nitrogen within the leguminous trees, let's say, don't count the bacteria, don't count the mycorrhizae, which are the nodulating bacteria, which are another set of associates. They're particularly linked to the plant itself, but there are lots of nitrogen-rich bacteria attached to the plant. But there are the rhizobium bacteria associated with leguminous groups. Don't count those. Where is the nitrogen hierarchy in the plant? The highest nitrogen in the plant or the tree is in the seeds, and they don't all germinate when they hit the floor. A lot of them that they can't. There's thousands, hundreds of thousands of seeds up there. They become nitrogen in the soil when they fall. Okay, the next highest is the pods of the seeds. They don't grow. They hit the floor and they rot to the soil. Then the leaves. Then the green tips of the plant or the tree, which are almost herbaceous on some legumes. They're sort of green on the ends. And then the wood. And some of the leguminous trees have up to 5% nitrogen just in the wood. Now, the figures I think you were quoting were very low. Now, okay. I mean, I don't need to argue about this when you see the proof of nature. If then later on I had to come back to my notes, Helen started to talk about, oh, she's been a very successful crop farmer, and wonderful. I think that's great that people are out there actually doing that stuff. But She then started to talk about green manures and people having simplistic manures, and when people only had green chip mulch, they got particular pill bugs or different types of monoculture mulch created monoculture pests, basically, and although they were being organic, they got problems. And she advocated all diversity of mulch was great. That's fantastic. That's true. But then she started to talk about leguminous green mulch. What do you mean, leguminous green mulch? You mean the stuff that falls off the trees that doesn't fix nitrogen unless you chop them? I mean, isn't that what I just said? That there's leaves and seeds and pods that have nitrogen, and yet Helen wants to say that there's leguminous green mulch that has lots of nitrogen. I mean, that's what falls off the trees, isn't it? I mean, you do have a winter when a lot of leaves fall down. You know, that's, you can't have it both ways. You either got to admit there are nitrogen interactions from legumes. Of course, we've got to open up for light, and we've got to disfavor one to favor another for the productive tree. So, yes, and as you move forward, there are less inputs over time. Of course, there are less inputs over time in both gardens and food forests. But, you know, kitchen gardens and diverse gardens are not necessarily natural systems.
Let me try and ask you the question that I once asked Helen, and that we basically kind of sort of talked about in that podcast, and so then you mentioned a moment ago about a number, and so I want to ask the question so that you can come back with the number. So let's talk about some generic legume. We won't mention any specific one, but some generic legume, and let's say it's an annual, and so then the question I want to ask you is, if we say that if we were to kill this legume, then it would, and then we work its top and its roots into the soil or whatever, or just, you know, and we say it gets 100 units of nitrogen, then go into the soil at its death, when the plant is dead, then during its lifetime, if we allow it up to the point before it dies, during its lifetime, how many units of nitrogen went into the soil during its life?
I'm not sure whether that comparative result has actually been researched within species and within location and climate. There would probably be quite a variation. I do remember seeing research in Vietnam around the amount of nitrogen that is actually released to the soil with leguminous trees over the area when they're alive, but I haven't seen the comparison between that and at the end of the life, or at the if the life of the plants are terminated intentionally. I haven't seen that comparative, but I've seen some impressive figures on the amount of nitrogen that is released to the soil while the trees are alive, and I'm going to have to try and recall it from memory, but it was something like 3,000 kilos to the hectare. And that was in relation to, you know, using trees as alley crop for growing crops between in a more tropical climate. But I think a lot of this research has to be done.
I think a lot of the research has been done. Now, during the podcast that I made with Helen, I threw out the number 2. And the reason why I threw out the number 2 is because I believe that in a previous podcast, I got her to agree to the number 2. Now, personally, when Helen's not in the room, I'm not trying to persuade her of this point. I believe the number is somewhere around, on average, with all the different climates, all the different species, I think the number is somewhere around 12. And it's going to depend on a variety of different things. But if nothing else, I do know that in Toby Hemingway's book, he mentions a study done, I believe it's by Cornell University, that when using the three sisters technique, that so it would be corn, pole beans, and squash, that they actually got a 20%, if I remember this correctly, I'm just doing this from memory, a 20% higher productivity in corn than if they were to just grow the corn by itself. So I would have to say that that reflects. I don't think some of the nitrogen is going to be taken up by the squash, but if nothing else, that's an at least 20% higher productivity, probably due to the nitrogen fixing. Although you could argue that it has to do with other elements as well, different shading and things like that. but I would think that corn being such a powerful nitrogen pig that it would have, I would think that there's going to be a direct relationship to the nitrogen fixing that's going on by the pole beans.
Yeah, I'd agree. And you've got sort of a minimum diversity stretched over an area. So what you've done there is you're using edge sinking to design for a commercial system, a crop system. So you've taken sort of a commercial polyculture approach to create a minimum diversity to stretch it over an area to produce a more stable crop result. So, you know, it's a good energy audit to produce a good economic income. It's a relationship between, you know, pattern, conformity, the landscape and climate that gets you to achieve these things. You can use that for tree systems. You can use that. So, you know, that's how we have to think. We have to come from, you know, the polycultural diversity, which is we know is functional, and we have to come down to a limited diversity to stretch out over the area. We know our systems are stable. We know they're extremely diverse. But if you want to stretch over the area for a commercial polycultural effect, you're edge sinking the diversity down so you can stretch it out over an area where agriculture is so dysfunctional and so monocultural and so unconforming with patterns that to come from the agricultural side towards the polyculture is rather a large journey with potentially a lot of failures on the way before you get to the edge that is on the right side of chaos. Chaos appears in natural systems and in all systems when the system is oversupplied with energy that it can't put to productive use. And agriculture puts so much energy into its efforts that it's way out on the chaos side of that line. But, you know, the most creative events happen right on the edge of chaos, just on the harmonic side of the chaos line.
So the most important part out of this segment that you're covering right now is that I'm right and Helen's wrong.
You're partially both right, but...
No! No!
but for your situation, I think there's a lot more research to be done on both sides. To choose the appropriate elements, and they're going to change from landscape to climate, and that's all an exciting journey for the listeners to engage in. That's what it comes down to.
So we had one of the Permies, one of the pod people, heard the podcast with Helen and George. And he went and did research, and he came back with 1,500 articles to support rhizodeposition in significant quantities. And so he found 1,500 white papers, peer-reviewed white papers, that show rhizodeposition. And there's links to it out at Permies. There's a thread about rhizodeposition to help provide all this supporting information. Now, I have to admit, I haven't gone and look at them. And, of course, the moment that he found that, I contacted Helen and said, Helen, guess who's right and who's wrong? And sent her out to look at it. But then she assured me that she hadn't looked at them either. So I'm just glad to know that it's there.
What is very interesting also is that when the leguminous trees, let's say, flower, that is the point when there's more nitrogen in the root zone. And as they produce seed, they draw nitrogen, more nitrogen from the rhizobium bacteria up to the top of the plant to produce the seeds, which have the highest hierarchy of nitrogen in the living plant. So if you want to put more nitrogen into the ground at a lower level, if it lines up with your seasonal cut when the dry season finishes and the rainy season period starts, if you happen to choose legumes that flower at that time, when you cut, you have more deposition of nitrogen into the soil. If you cut when they're actually seeding, and remember the seeds won't all germinate, you're dropping more nitrogen at the surface in the surface mulch. So there's even a timing event from up to down, down to up, that you can play with.
So I believe that the one other point that Helen and I were having some argument about in that podcast was when you guys went out to Tagari Farm and there was a food forest there that it had been 7 years, if I recall correctly, it had been in the video, it had been 7 years since anybody had been to that location. And so then Helen and I were debating about, because I think at one point in time you said 7 years ago this was all grass. And I imagine it would be a dried up brown grass, and then now it continues to be a food forest even without anybody being there to tend to it.
Yep. What has happened there is that there was food forest that went back 12 years old, once you get that intrinsic mass of some size, now there's some debate about what size is has integrity. I think 150 square meters probably has integrity. But once it gets to some sort of level of climax, they actually, if they're good systems, start to expand a bit. They actually grow outwards. And then when you have areas where there's just a small bit of grass between two areas of food forest that you haven't yet started, it starts to close in and finish the job for you quite quickly when there's small areas. So if you've got, you know, a quarter of an acre or less in the middle of a well-established food forest that's, say, 10 years plus, it gets engulfed by food forests. The grass doesn't grow outwards. You know, the paddock doesn't invade the food forest. If you've got it right, the food forest actually starts to grow. and there was a lot of those events that we were observing, and it was a bit of a wonder trying to figure out what was going on. But there are lots of different time sequences of establishment on that property, right from when Bill started to when I left. I was only the manager there for, I was renting and managing the place for 3.5 years. So some of those food forests were established just after we left, but they were on the edge of established systems, and because of that, they continued to grow. If they'd have been out in the open paddock, they'd have been out in the middle of grassland, and they were just newly established, and we walked away, they probably would have struggled. And we're improving that ability. We're improving the ability to grow right out of the long grass. But that's generally what you were seeing, a whole mixture of stuff. But some wonderful advancement. Now, if you go to that system now, it's full of wildlife as well. Like there's these native birds called bush turkeys, which are almost the size of your native turkey, and there's small wallaby in there, and you know, you can kind of go in there and hunt and gather now. It's kind of like walk in there and it's like a menagerie of things in there. It's kind of curious.
Which is what I think we're all kind of shooting for. I mean, I think I said something in the podcast about how it's like, you know, yeah, this is permaculture, because I think that the idea is that you create a system which is effectively a gift to your future self, and you don't have to do anything more. You can just go and harvest year after year. Now, if you go in there and you romance it a little bit, then it'll produce even more. But if you do nothing at all, it'll continue to produce.
Yeah, I mean, you can document systems like on the northwest coast of New Guinea, where and a lot of introduced plants like cassava and not native, all native plants, there are food forests that almost go from village to village, and people have forgotten how they planted them or how, and they don't really understand what maintenance is. Maintenance is the effect of harvesting. So literally, they've mixed harvesting with maintenance in mature systems, and harvesting is maintenance and replanting by accident. And it's like it's fascinating to see what that does to the general culture in their approach to life. It's very interesting, and it's more or less unintentional. And I think we have to be intentional to do this, and we have to pass the knowledge forward. But there are some fascinating things, luckily, still out there to study.
Okay, so I think the point that I was trying to make is that I believe that there were multiple food forests in place there, and some were older than others, and some of them were planted just before you left. But I think you may have just said that anything that you may have planted just before you left probably died, or that it did continue on, and then we were seeing that in the video.
Yeah, what we're saying there was, by the time we left, almost everything we were planting, we were adding on to older food forests which were established, and they nurtured the system forward. In fact, in some places they were next to access ways and farm tracks, and they started to close off the farm track even. And there were some very difficult areas that we struggled with initially, and they closed right off into very stable forests. And they were still grassy and weedy when we left, and I looked as I left and thought, I'm probably not going to make it, and I was wrong. They really made it very, very into a very secure system, unstoppable. So I don't act on these videos that we do on these DVDs. A lot of time it's absolutely ad lib, and I'm actually in a bit of a state of wonder. Wow, look at this stuff. And Frank just follows me with the camera and picks it all up and edits it together. So it's kind of real time that's edited down to an educational DVD.
And before I forget, I want to ask the question, do you have any new DVDs coming out soon?
We've thrown around the idea of doing pattern. I'd really like to do pattern. I think I could make it fascinating to permies and non-permies alike, which might hook some new recruits to service the world with permaculture. I think you know Jack Spurko is survivalist.com or survival.
It's the survivalpodcast.com, and yes, I know Jack real well.
So Jack interviewed me the other week, and he was fascinated with the food forest DVD as well, and he wants me to do a temperate climate, cool climate food forest DVD, and said if I make up a Kickstarter proposal, he'll do his best to get it funded, and was confident he could help us with that. And so that could be on the cards. It would mean a bit of traveling, because we haven't got, except for our mountain districts in Australia, we haven't got really cold. We have some mountain areas that are a bit cold, but that's altitude as well. So it'd mean a bit of a European, North American film trip. I'm really interested in helping people get what they want from DVDs. If people want particular DVD titles, we'll do our best. I mean, we could do all of them again. Well, we could definitely do water harvesting again and food forests again, because we have the same systems that we could cut over and time lapse that you would see very different things now. much larger systems on the same film set. But we'd like to be able to do a travel analog. It's not cheap to make these DVDs. There's a lot of specific editing, and of course you see there's a lot of explanation through different sort of cartoon sequences and and we're doing explanations in that way to simplify it. But if we were to get a budget to travel and put together sort of international examples, if people like my presentation style, which they seem to, we'd be more than welcome to facilitate that and get it out there.
Cool. Yeah, I really like the idea that you would do more on the greening the desert stuff, because I kind of feel like when you can convey that bit of knowledge about greening the desert, then suddenly I think a lot of people are far more receptive. Like it becomes easier for them, because if you do something about greening the desert where there's only 6 inches of rain, and then people are like someplace where there's 12 inches of rain, then they can say that it must be possible where I am, because look, it was done where there was only 6 inches of rain.
Yeah, I mean, because of that green in the desert video, our work in the deserts has really increased. Where I started off working with Ali Sharif in the Amazon when I first started working overseas, and I was in some of the wettest areas of the world, but somehow I ended up in some of the driest, and then now we're working in areas with 2 inches of rain, but we have projects that are just exploding through the drylands areas of North Africa and the Middle East. New PRI Morocco, Algeria's lining up, Mauritania's on the way, Tunisia's on the way, urban agriculture, perimeter urban agriculture. Libya, now huge inquiry coming in from Libya, huge. Egypt's firing, Jordan, Lebanon. Syria, we've got people chomping at the bit in Syria, just waiting for it to settle down. They're going to hit the ground absolutely flat out in Syria. They're just ready to go. Saudi Arabia, we have some major projects happening in Saudi Arabia. Yemen has a whole new institute, incredible institute in Yemen going up. We've got an inquiry from Oman that's working with John D. Louis from the Lewis Plateau. We've formed a working alliance there. John D. Louis wants a permaculture institute at the center of all his large landscape rehabilitation. The United Arab Emirates, we've got a whole emirate underway. It's hot. It's a hot thing over there in the Middle East and North Africa, and they're mostly all Arabic-speaking countries, so the text is going to spread fast. A lot of the rest of the world might be playing catch-up pretty soon, I think.
Yeah, as these places, which were considered just simply deserts to be ignored, start producing big gobs of food.
Especially as you might see just recently, there's a BBC report on this, that there's some of the largest aquifers ever discovered have just been discovered underneath North Africa and the Sahara.
I was doing a podcast with Owen Hablitzel, who's one of your guys.
Yeah.
We were talking about the Sahara, because he'd been out there, and he mentioned that camel meat tastes good, and we were talking about how that greening would work out there. But yeah, I feel like I've derailed you from the earlier quest, and that was to go through all of your notes from the review of the review. Did you get to the end of the list?
I did. I got to the end of the list.
Well, I was kind of hoping that you were going to say that for the nitrogen fixing thing, that I was clearly right and Helen was clearly wrong. But it turns out that you're saying that we are both right. I suppose that we're both right because it depends upon the species.
It does. The species, the application, all of those things. Maybe I'm just too nice a guy to say you're right. Either of you are wrong. I just appreciate both of you.
Yes, you are a very nice man. I am far ruder, far more direct, and not so worried about offending. I guess I'm offensive. That's what it is. I'm offensive. That was okay. So that was good. What else have we got? Is there anything else that you feel like you need to mention for this podcast?
No, I think we're coming to the end of things there. I was just mentioning how great work Owen's done and Ramis Kent. They've both been out there, two of our guys, out to the Sahara, trying to help people out there in refugee camps. There are people who are working in such hard places now with great courage and conviction. It's a wonderful thing. I'm so grateful for so many people many have volunteered to help on projects and gain experience through their volunteering and then gone on to, you know, apply permaculture as consultants who are so much in demand. So, you know, everybody should just keep moving forward. We're on the right track.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Lawton. If you like this sort of thing, come on out to the forums at permies.com, where we talk about the works of Jeff Lawton, homesteading, and permaculture all the time.